Buddhist Summer School, Thursday, 3rd September 1981. We started our week this year considering the invocation Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. And we began with the consideration of what is implied in the word Namo, which means homage or veneration. And you may remember that we regarded it as involving the complete giving of oneself to the Buddha, which implied also in its turn that such a complete giving unreservedly and unconditionally meant true love in its supreme sense, a love which is altogether unpossessive, which makes no demands whatsoever, and which will always be love whatsoever the other may do to us. Now, a Buddha can shatter us, of course, because what we are in ourselves, because of our imperfections, sometimes may need not gentle treatment, but treatment which is like an earthquake. It completely cuts the ground under our feet. All that we believed in, what we held dear and so forth, all that gets wiped out. And it's a tremendous shock. And this happens again and again where a true spiritual teacher who is a perfected holy one himself is concerned in relation to me, the ordinary person. Now there is an aspect of this which we must touch upon today, and that is the fact that this acceptance of the teacher implies also complete fidelity, utter faithfulness, and therefore it means that we must have complete faith in the one whom we regard as the teacher. There is a lovely saying in Hindu India, it's actually a teaching, a religious teaching: God, the teacher, the parents, and the guest, five people concerned, are all on an equal footing. Now, if we try to look at it carefully, we will see just how ancient India at least looked at the situation. The guest is somebody who comes from outside to the house. He, sometimes a stranger comes along. Any stranger who comes was treated as a guest. He is placed on the same footing as the teacher, God, and one's parents. One can easily conceive of fidelity and faith towards the idea of God and, of course, to the living teacher, up to a point though, because we may have reservations. But to include all of them, the parents whom one loves, the guest, the stranger, if you like, and God are all on an equal footing. And this implies remarkable faith. Faith in what? Where the Buddha is concerned, faith in the Buddha. And I'd like to read you a little passage in the Itivuttaka, the sayings, they are considered as the authentic sayings of the Buddha himself on this question of faith. This was said by the Exalted One. Monks, there are three best faiths. What three? As compared with creatures, whether footless, bipeds, quadrupeds, or those with many feet. You see how he includes the whole of the living world thereby. Insects, things which fly, bipeds, ourselves, quadrupeds,
centipedes,
and the whole lot of them. With form or void of form. I don't quite follow the void of form where living creatures are concerned. But he does use the word creatures as compared with creatures. With sense or void of sense or indeterminate in sense. A Tathagata, Arahant, a rightly awakened one, is reckoned best of them. They who have faith in a Buddha have faith in the best. Of those who have faith in the best, the result is best. Now, let us try and see the implication of faith in the best, of faith in the Buddha. Most people in the world have faith in something or other, some teacher or other, some system or other, and so forth. But most people have the elements, at least, of blind faith. Where the Buddha is concerned, wisdom lies not in having a blind faith. One has, to some degree or other, seen what the Buddha stands for, what he is in himself. We may read words like those which were said by Kacchana, Mahakacchana, that he is Dhamma become, Brahma become. Now that's a tremendous thing to say. Brahma become, in Buddhistic terms and in Hindu terms, is the equivalent of become God in the theistic religions. That's what it means. Now, if we have blind faith in this, we will always get some sort of shock or other sooner or later. Why? Because we ourselves are so conditioned to start with that we have concepts of what God is. Or if we haven't got concepts of what God is, we have an idea of what God ought to be. Now, this of course, at first hearing sounds a little bit comic, but it can be extremely serious. If a person undergoes a devastating, a catastrophic misfortune or sorrow in life. Take a husband and wife who are very deeply devoted, completely love each other and so forth, and they are dependent upon each other. They are dependent upon each other because of that. They cannot stand on their own feet separately. This is the point to bear in mind. And if one of the partners dies, and especially if he or she dies in an unfortunate way or something like that, then the one who is left is absolutely desolated, completely desolated. And because of that desolation, he tends to say, "Where was my God? What was he doing? How could this happen to me if my God is good and loving and all the rest of it?" Isn't that true? How many people suffer in that way? You see, So you see, in a situation like that, that aspect of transcendence, the teacher or God to whom we gave our trust and our faith, as we called it, had a weak link, a weak point somewhere. So that when a worldly experience, which was very sorrowful, struck us, then we lost faith in the transcendent itself. You see? That which is worldly is imperfect on the whole. I'm not thinking like this, that if you have a machine, you can make a perfect machine. There is no doubt about that. But anything worldly, and living creatures particularly, we are imperfect. We are so attached to the imperfect. It means so much to us that if we lose that and we feel the pain of it, we lose our faith in the eternal, the immortal, the transcendent. So now, faith in the Buddha, as the Buddha says, of those who have faith in the best, faith in the Buddha is called faith in the best, and those who have faith in the best, the result is best. So you see, nothing can shake that faith. There is nothing in us, because of our imperfection, which will allow that faith to be shaken. So we must bear that in mind. The faith must not be a blind faith. There must be knowledge. To what extent can we have knowledge of the Buddha? If we examine the teachings carefully and we see that our living experience corroborates those teachings to a certain extent at least, and if we are capable of being sensitive to the perfection, the utter perfection and holiness of the Buddha, then our faith is likely to be a true faith. The monks had this utter trust and faith in the Buddha, but there was the example of Devadatta, who caused a schism amongst the monks. His faith was not a true faith. What was it that interfered there? His own self-esteem, his own evaluation of himself as a separate person. So he left the order and took away 500 monks with him, it is said. So those 500 monks could not have had, 501, including Devadatta, could not have had true faith, a pure faith. Now we must notice one other point in this business of pure faith. The complete self-giving, which implies complete and whole love, must be non-sentimental, and there must be no element of attachment involved in it. The Buddha himself completely loved all his monks, but he was not attached to any one of them. You study the life carefully, as you find it revealed in the various discourses, and you will see that there is no trace whatsoever of attachment, of being bound, therefore, to the loved one. If one is not bound to the loved one, then not only are you free, but the loved one is also free. If one gets attached to the loved one, then one lays down conditions. One is conditionally loving. If If you live like this and this and this, my love will continue always. But if you don't, and if you make this, that or the other, what I consider a mistake, then that's the end. Goodbye. You see, this is a very important point, the utter freedom from attachment. And you may recall, I think it was yesterday, I said something about in the yoga discipline, pratyahara, which is the step named after pranayama. Pratyahara really means complete freedom from all attachment or aversion in relation to anyone or anything. So now we'll go on. Then the Buddha says, as compared with things compounded or not compounded, freedom from passion is reckoned best of them. Namely, the subduing of pride in self, the restraint of thirst, tanha, the thirst for sentient existence and so on, the removal of clinging to anything and everything. It's one of the important aspects of his teaching. The cutting off of the basis of birth, of the conditioned state, the word used is jati in the Pali, the destruction of craving, freedom from passion, ending, bringing to an end that which is the ephemeral, that which has come into being, which has had its run its course, and then it must end. And Nibbana. They who have faith in Dhamma, which is passionless, have faith in the best. So it's faith in the Buddha and faith in the Dhamma. Now, this business of the removal of clinging. It is very important to notice how the Buddha, when he talks of the five khandhas as such, and shows that every one of them, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana, all of them are impermanent. Therefore, do not cling to any one of them whatsoever. Not only insofar as they constitute us, the existential being in the world which we experience as the psychophysical person, not only in relationship to us, but in relationship to all our ideas, our feelings, our thoughts, our beliefs that this is the truth, and so on. According to the stage, our stage of development, we have convictions that, this is true. But the Buddha says, don't cling to it. Or sometimes we have what we call an inspiration or a revelation or whatever it is. The Buddha says, all right, don't cling to it. Go through the experience, look at it, see it for what it is, see the fact as the fact. Which is extremely difficult. Because we all have our standards of judgment and this, that and the other, and they are all immature and imperfect. We are the slaves of our unwarrantable preconceptions and assumptions. And we are also enslaved by our prejudices and our biases. By bias I mean the natural tendency within us, a natural leaning. One has a bias by virtue of one's constitution to this, that or the other. Which is not always wrong. It may be a bias which indicates some gift you have, some ability you have, and that is to be cultivated as such. But one is not to be attached to it. One mustn't cling to it. And this is not at all easy. I know from personal experience what tremendous distress it causes when something which you believed as truth absolute truth. Nothing could be wrong about that, you see. As the years passed, and when I say years, I don't mean 4, 5, 10 or 15. I mean 40 and 50. I mean 70 years have passed since, over 70 years have passed since I was interested in things like this and believed certain things. And after 70 years, I was able to give them up. You see, this clinging is very powerful because it means because that which you believe to be true and so forth is security. You see, take for example the Christian statement: believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved. Now, what is the real meaning of all that? Most people's belief in the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved amounts to absolution for all your wrongdoings when you are dying. You see, I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, therefore I won't be chucked into hell, which I jolly well deserve. You see, that it's not that kind of belief. It must be utterly free of clinging to any and every idea, any and every conception. Because if we cling to an idea and make it a mental fixation, it will always keep us back. It won't allow us to grow. Growth means change. If a child of 5 or 6 just stayed put in that condition and didn't grow anymore, well, what would happen? But as it grows and reaches full adulthood and manhood or womanhood, you see, as the case may be, the body, to consider the body alone, the body must change. Change means dying to what is in order that the new may emerge freely. This is one of the most difficult things to deal with. We feel so secure in our fixations. Oh, I've got a good salary now, and I've got a house and a garden and this, that and the other, and let it continue forever and ever as such, unchanged. Well, generally speaking, the house will continue after I'm dead and somebody else will come and inhabit it. But that attitude of not of avoiding change is the attitude which prevents our development and growth and full fruition as human beings. The purpose of our existence is frustrated thereby if we don't change all the time inside. But the change must not be whimsical. It mustn't be fortuitous, a useless change, you see. Nor should we allow ourselves to change regressively. After having observed temperance for 40 years, we say, oh, we'll have a little drink now. And the good old Japanese proverb, you know, first the man takes a drink, then the drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. Of course, put in that way, it sounds funny, but look at the tragic consequences, especially in our modern world. Look at this business of drugs and so forth, and how many lives are absolutely ruined by it. Absolutely ruined. And the most poignant part of the tragedy is that it captures the young. It's terrible to think of young children in their teens being the slaves of drugs and so forth, you see. So this element of clinging is an important element to bear in mind and to deal with. And he finishes that part of his statement by saying, they who have faith in Dhamma have faith in the best. Of those who have faith in the best, the result is the best. You will see that the best, as understood and presented by a perfected Holy One is so different from what we consider the best. Our best is, it has got a little bit of dust and dirt upon it. Then he goes on, as compared with orders and companies, that is to say, you know, the groups which prevailed in those days, this is what we would call this society or that society in our time. As compared with orders and companies, the order of a Tathagata's disciples is reckoned the best. Namely, the four pairs of very man, the eight types of very man, in man that is, the exalted one's order of disciples, worthy of honor are they, worthy of reverence, worthy of offerings, worthy of salutations with clasped hands, a field of merit unsurpassed for the world. Monks, they who have faith in the order, have faith in the best. Of those who have faith in the best, the result is best. Now, I don't understand myself. I have no idea at all what is meant here. The four pairs of very man. The eight types of very man. Does anyone have any ideas about that?
V-E-R-Y.
Of very man. The eight types of very man. A man, that is, the exalted one's order of disciples.
Could it refer to us being subhuman now? And then only when we become enlightened do we become fully human.
Oh, wait a minute, I'm sorry. There is a footnote here which explains. Although I'm a critical scholar, I mean, when I study things, one can miss things. Those on the four paths of stream winner, once returner, no returner, and arahant, divided into two stages each, the second stage being that of fruit winner. So that makes the four and the eight types and so forth. The text has four Purisa and eight Purisa Puggala. Those are the birds in the Pali. Yes, well, I've learned something now. Now, with regard to the Sangha, we must bear in mind that this company, the Buddha Sangha, is not like our ordinary worldly societies or Sanghas. You become a member of such and such a society, you sign on the dotted line, you send in your check for being allowed to be a member and so on. That is not the Sangha. The Sangha, the Buddha's Sangha, was supposed to consist of bhikkhus who actually lived the life successfully. I forget where I saw this, but where I read this, but it is in one of the texts. That is what the Sangha means in the Buddhist teaching. You see the tremendous responsibility to be a member of the Sangha. And one who lives the life. Otherwise, well, you're a mere signed on the dotted line member. That's no use at all. So these are the three best faiths: in the Buddha, in the Dhamma, and in the Sangha. And whoso has faith in these three best, for him the results are best. This is a tremendous thing to say. It's like a promise that if such and such is the case, then the Buddha himself stands surety that the best result will come to you. And a Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one, certainly has perfect ground for saying such a thing. Now, I don't know whether any of you have noticed in this, in the discourses, that the Buddha talks, I think it comes in the second or maybe the third volume of the Majjhima. It's not in the first. That is to say, the translated volumes. The translation of the first volume of the Pali Majjhima, it's so long that it spills over into the first few pages of the second volume of the translated Majjhima, you see. The Buddha says of a person who is concerned with living the religious life, what he does and how he does it. He hears of a Buddha, a Tathagata, a perfected holy one. He hears about him and he's attracted by what he hears. So he approaches him. He approaches him and sits down near him, maybe asks questions and so forth, and he listens to what the teacher says. He listens to what the teacher says. Listening to the teacher, what the teacher says, he then practices or attempts to practice what the teacher says, especially first through reflection, careful consideration. It's a very important point, through careful consideration. And let us remember the meaning of the word consider. What is our idea of, what do we mean by the word consider? It comes from Sidus Sideris, a star. To look intently into a star is the root meaning of the word consider. But what is a star? It is a self-shining light, isn't it? It does not reflect light from anywhere else. It is a self-shining light. So you see the extraordinarily deep meaning of the word consider and the other word consideration, what consideration means. It's not merely just an act of good manners or just being nice to another person or helping him on and so on. It means seeing him as you would see a self-shining light. Yes, this reflection, deep consideration of what he hears. And then, after he has considered it deeply, he is probably, this is of course the procedure with any disciple or monk, as the case may be, he is examined by the one in whose charge he is placed, and the appointed teacher helps that monk or disciple, corrects him where mistakes are concerned, advises him, shows him how he may get along in order to make real progress. That is followed by real deep meditation, in the real sense. The lesser part of the real sense. Now, this practice of which you'll find given out in the Majjhima is the exact correspondent of what was practiced by the Brahmanical teachers, by the Brahman teachers. They called it Shravana, which is the hearing, the listening, Manana, which is the reflection, the thinking it out, and Nididhyasana, the deep meditation part. But by this method, what happened was that the pupil was conditioned in a particular way. It's like a person who takes a course in theology. He learns all the ideas and the teachings and so on. He knows them parrot-wise to start with, and then also in some deep way or other also. And the meditation throws considerable light upon the whole thing and gives him a certain amount of insight. But that means that that the person is turned out as a proficient Brahman or Bhikkhu, somewhat after the fashion of someone who has got his Bachelor of Divinity degree in a university. He's proficient with regard to the teachings. He's proficient with regard to any of the ritual observances associated with the teaching, the ceremonies and so forth. But then, in the Upanishadic teachings, you will find this. If that person who is a Bachelor of Divinity has the ability, the earnestness and the true passion to become one with the truth, in other words to develop into the perfected Holy One, then he by the Maharishis, and if you appreciate this, you will appreciate how people in the modern world, unfortunately from India and also from other parts, style themselves Maharishi. And it's terrible that they do so. The Maharishi then gives that person what are called the Mahavakyas, the great sayings. The great sayings were simple as far as the words go. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Perhaps it would be better to translate it the other way around. Brahman is me. Because I am Brahman gives the impression that this person has attained that stage which is designated as Brahman, the absolute all. Well, we existential beings, as long as we are alive, never attain anything like that. That is why I prefer to translate it as Brahman is me. All right. The other Mahavakya is the famous Tat Tvam Asi. That thou art. That, the capital T-H-A-T, meaning the supreme, the beyond all expression and so forth. And another form of that same statement, when the person is saying it of himself, is Tad Asmi. Asmi I am. I am that. That I am. You see? And you will notice how the Buddha tells his monks and tells anybody who is ill, particularly. He starts off with just a friendly greeting in the first place, and then goes on to say, is rupa permanent or impermanent? And the man answers, impermanent, Lord. Then is it right to regard the impermanent as painful or happy? Painful, Lord. Then says the Buddha, put aside all attachment, all clinging to the impermanent. and recognize that this is not me. This is not the self of me. He always uses that word atta when he speaks that. And the atta, of course, is the correspondent of the Upanishadic atma. It's very interesting. And then he says, do not cling to this at all. Put it aside with right wisdom. The Brahmanical teachers then went on to point out that a super Shravana, Manana and Nididhyasana is to follow. And that Shravana is not something which the already conditioned but well-trained disciple has to listen to, but that prince of yogis, Yajnavalkya, tells Paingala, for instance, that hearing consists in your own open-minded investigation. Your own open-minded investigation, putting aside all that you already have heard and know and realized through your meditation and so forth. You see how they put it in a form which is really absolutely complete. If you do that, you utterly cut the ground under your feet. But you see, if you utterly cut the ground under your feet, you won't get hurt. You won't fall. There is no such thing as falling in the cosmos. We need some sort of support. We are afraid. So we fear that if all this is cut away from me, I shall fall. But if you can jump off the planet, try it. Jump off the planet and see what happens. You'll fall nowhere. You are in infinite space. You're perfectly safe. This stepping out into the unknown is one of the things that brings about tremendous fear. It's one of the meanings of the fear of the Lord as presented in the Bible. Stepping out into the unknown. But step out into the unknown and there'll be no fall. Take that other phrase, underneath are the everlasting arms. You see how wonderful it is that all these teachings really fit in with each other in their own particular way. And then, after that Shravana, the investigation by yourself, and the reflection which goes with it, that this reflection is not the sort of reflection one went through when one was the beginner. When one begins, one uses one's brain and one's knowledge which one has gathered. But this reflection is the entry into the deeper states of consciousness, especially after the second jhana. What happens in the second jhana? All conceptualizing and verbalizing has ceased. This is the first entry into the transcendent silence. It is the movement through the first great portal of death. Death not meaning death as we understand it, of the organism and so forth. Not in that sense. Not in the sense of any sort of destruction. It is the entry out of this life into the other life, the transcendent life. You go through that first portal of silence. Now why is the silence so important? What does it imply? First, we learn silence as far as the tongue is concerned. It would be very, very good if people all over the world were to were to stand by and observe the injunction, if thy tongue offend thee, cut it off. You know, Jesus put some of these, the transcendental aspect of the moralities, in a very fierce form, didn't he? If thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. And so on, you see. But don't do it literally. Understand what it means and do it. If thy tongue cause offense by wagging unnecessarily and too much, cut it off. In other words, to put it in simple English, shut up. Practice it. It's of wonderful merit and wonderful, it's spiritually health giving. But having done that, do bear in mind that the brain will keep on talking 100 to the dozen. You can't cut that off deliberately. You have to let it subside. Now, in the second, you know how in the first jhana there is applied thought and discursive thought, you see. All right. When that quietens down and the flow of discursive thought has completely stopped naturally and spontaneously, you are deep in the second jhana as such. What has happened? All words, all talking has ceased. Silent. The brain talks silently. When we say I think, all that is happening is that I am talking silently to myself. That is all. All our thinking is a flow of words, or maybe pictures or sounds, whatever. But it's something to do with the physical senses. All right. Now, words represent all that is material, all that is mortal. Objects, people, situations, and so forth. So you see, as long as there is this flow of words, we are imprisoned in the realm of mortality, because the ideas and thoughts and speech comes up, it goes on, it finishes, it dies, you see. So you are conscious of yourself and the world in terms of mortality. But if that flow stops by itself, in what manner are you conscious now? If the mood of mortality has given place to this other mood, what is that other mood in which you are conscious? You are conscious in the mood of immortality. And that experiencing is your first taste of the real immortality. Your actual experience of immortality here and now, whilst the body is alive. This is something which people have never understood or appreciated. This is the meaning of the cessation of the flow of discursive thought. And then when you go into the higher stages, you go ultimately to what the Buddha called the cessation of all perception and feeling. So then there is the emergence into the sphere of the transcendence itself, and the purpose of your existence has been fulfilled, because now you are utterly purified and you are the holy grail, so to say, which enables the energy and power of transcendence itself to flow freely through you. It enters into you and flows out of you. You are then a benediction to the world in which you live. Well, now, this is our last meeting in this year's Buddhist summer school. And yet, in a way, a last meeting is not a last meeting. If we have truly met each other, met in terms of loving kindness, friendliness, and have considered together and have appreciated and understood something of what has taken place in these meetings, then that process will go on when we are away from here. That is how it happens in the psyche, especially when we are concerned with deep things, with spiritual things. Because this sort of consideration is a stimulus to the dormant spiritual energies lying within us. And those energies continue to work without our knowing it. They continue to work, and they'll continue to inspire you and show you the right way, as and when one allows those energies to work. Which means, of course, that we have to live mindfully all the time. I hope we have all appreciated the kindness of nature this year. We have had beautiful sunshine, and this place itself is wonderfully beautiful, really. Whenever I look at the trees, especially the line of the trees, especially early in the morning, or at sunset, it feels as if all nature is in meditation, as if all the trees are praying. That is how it feels, so to say. And you will, if one is sensible enough to remain quiet and sensitive at that time, you will feel the unity with nature. That is the first unity we can actually experience. Thousands of people do experience it. People who live in the country, for instance, I don't suggest everyone, but a good many people who live in the country are very sensitive to this kinship with nature. And it is not just a poetic emotion as such, it is a material fact. This organism, this body, for instance, is made up of the same chemical elements that makes up the whole of nature. It's the same old carbon, hydrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, nitrogen, and so on, you see. So there's a real unity. And what is one of the most powerful factors in making that unity real for us is remaining silent. It is the silence particularly which speaks to us in such a way that it is the most powerful stimulus to experience consciously, to live in that sense of unity with nature. So I hope that we all have taken advantage of the situation. And enjoyed the beauty of the world, this part of the world in which we had the privilege of coming for a week. Take that spirit with you, and you will find it will help you very much to keep going, to keep going. What may have been gathered in our meetings here. Because nature, or matter if you like, is not different from spirit. The unitary wholeness of the one total reality is really altogether indescribable. It is absolutely extraordinary, this unitary wholeness. And insofar as we remain quiet and in tune with it all, our inner consciousness wakes up to transcendent reality, and the transcendent ceases to be an intellectual exercise, a philosophy of life, a conception in the brain merely. No, it becomes a tremendous reality. And you will actually know, you will actually experience the real meaning of the word ananda. Ananda means not just joy or happiness. That is piti and sukha and so forth, the Pali words. But this ananda is pure bliss. It's an extraordinary thing. It has no excitement in it. It has nothing which puts you into a state of ecstasy, a state beside yourself. The whole point of our growth and fulfillment and development is not to be beside ourselves, but to be wholly ourselves, poised and in equanimity. See, the Buddha talks of that again and again, the importance of being poised and perfectly in perfect equanimity. The pure mindfulness then can function. And that pure mindfulness will not be restricted just to the discursive observational process, where you are using your senses and sense perceptions only. Deeper perceptions will come about. But you must beware, as and when you experience this kind of thing, don't get misled into believing, I am becoming clairvoyant and developing wonderful psychic powers and so forth. If you do develop some wonderful psychic powers, just put them in the safe and lock them up there, you see. Psychic powers can be a great danger to spiritual progress, because they invariably bring up some degree or other of pride and self-esteem and so forth. This is one of the tragic aspects of succeeding in anything in life. When we succeed in anything in life, whether it be something material or whether it be something artistic or whatever it is, you see, we become conceited about it, and we tend to regard other people who haven't got that same ability as of a lesser breed or a lesser grade. And therefore, with that sort of awareness in relationship to others, we are spoiling the unity of the universe. We are not acknowledging the fact that everything that is absolutely unique. The entire cosmos went into bringing that into being. Do we ever despise a blade of grass? Or do we appreciate it and understand it and recognize it for what it is? If we trample upon a blade of grass, it goes down like that. When we step off it, that blade of grass will come up. If an elephant trampled upon me, could I ever come up again? No, think of this very, very carefully. So you see, if one is really awake to the uniqueness and the beauty and the marvel of everything that is around us, there'll be real love in the profound sense, without attachment, without demanding anything for oneself. And this is very, very important. If one is free of demanding for oneself and laying down how the other person should love us and so forth, then there can be no discord and disharmony between that person and ourselves. There can be no jealousy then. Not only no jealousy, but there will never be the feeling of envy when we see two people who are really happy in their loving relationship towards each other. See, this is a very important point, because the world today suffers so much from lack of love. Our greatest problem is not poverty with regard to goods and money and that sort of thing. Our greatest poverty is the lack of love. It's the commodity which is most short in the world. And remember that love, in its reality, in its transcendence, is a self-replenishing energy, a self-replenishing power. If real love is there, it doesn't need influences or stimuli or acts by other people to support that love and to sustain it and nourish it. Not at all. It is self-existent. When, as for example, in the Bible, in the New Testament, I think it is one of the epistles of
St. Paul, Corinthians.
No, not Corinthians. I'm thinking of something else. As St. John, it's John's epistle or one of those epistles towards the end of the New Testament. God is love. Now you see, how do the millions translate that? The love that they know is essentially just plain, straightforward, honest-to-goodness sexual love. And that sort of feel which they have in their inner consciousness of love absolutely stains their understanding of the statement that God is love. There is no possessiveness, no jealousy, no demand. It never diminishes, it never increases, because that which is the full, the infinite, cannot diminish or grow more. It is infinite. And it is that sort of love which will not only fill your heart, but it is something which will function through and through in your consciousness. And perhaps for the first time, you then wake up to the real meaning of consciousness. The pure consciousness is an unknowing knowing. And it functions naturally and spontaneously, requiring no direction from you to act or feel or think thus and thus to express love. Not that way. Because as long as it is not in that state of unknowing knowing, there is always the awareness of myself as the knowing subject, and the other person or thing or whatever it is as the observed and known object. There is a separation, in fact. Love is the complete unification in the deeps of consciousness. And that is just divine, isn't it? Look at how the Buddha presented love in its four aspects. Metta, Karuna, Mudita and Upekkha. It's not original to the Buddha. You will find it in the Brahmanical writings, which are pre-Buddhistic. You will find it also in Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. Those four are mentioned just like that, you see. Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekha. They are just mentioned straight off like that. Now, the way the Buddha presents it as loving kindness, friendship, friendliness to start with. And then compassion. The quivering of one's own whole being in sympathy with that towards which this compassion flows. I've just forgotten the Pali words. But the compassion is something which is quivering, or constantly quivering, constantly vibrating. And as soon as there is the situation where compassion is called for, it flows out of you. But in your inner consciousness, this has become a reality. Your innermost consciousness. You are not aware of it. You don't know it. If you know it and you can say to yourself, I am compassionate, you have spoilt compassion to that degree. When you are truly conscious of love, then you are love embodied. Whatever you are truly conscious of, you are that thing embodied. And naturally and spontaneously, that thing, love or wisdom, beauty, truth, goodness, functions freely in through all your thinking and feeling, your existential thinking and feeling, your speaking and your doing. This is the deep meaning of consciousness. I sometimes wonder whether when Jung talked of the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious, whether he had some sort of idea like that at the back of his mind. But this consciousness is not the limited consciousness of I am conscious of that. There's no separation. You are that completely in mind and consciousness. And this is the sense in which the great mystics and the perfected holy ones talked of the unio mystica, the unity with the transcendent. So such is the nature of love. And the whole world very much needs this. Who but people like ourselves can try to express that kind of loving kindness and compassion particularly, if we are really concerned with the world. We make a great mistake in thinking that by changing our systems, by having a new way of doing things, by technological advances and all the rest of the claptrap, the sorrow of the world can be solved. Nothing of the sort will happen. Nothing of the sort can happen. All that can be the consequence of the transformed consciousness. You see, how many of us realize that consciousness in each one of us is something which we just don't know? We cannot characterize it. It's vijnanam anidassanam. That is the real consciousness, anidassanam. You see? But the inner state of our consciousness is the power which expresses itself through all our mental and emotional states, and our feelings, and our words, and our actions. All these are the expressions, that which is pushed out of our inner consciousness. That inner consciousness is the sort of sacred adytum, where the Holy of Holies resides. that inner consciousness is not our property. Like vijnana, we can say my vijnana, my discriminative consciousness. But we can never say my vijnanam anidarsanam, for which the Upanishads had the simple word atma. The Buddha's vijnanam anidarsanam is the exact equivalent, as far as I can see, of the Upanishadic atma. And there's plenty of evidence throughout the discourses to show that. So, all our existential expression throughout our daily life is the result of our consciousness. And our existential expression in terms of our thoughts and feelings and words and actions, in turn, subtly influence our state of our consciousness. Consciousness, I think I did mention it, didn't I, one afternoon, that mind and consciousness are universals. They are not particulars. So you can't say mine with respect to them. They are universals. And the universal is affected by the particular. You see, our tremendous responsibility as human beings. Modern science itself has now discovered, if you want to know all about one thing, you have to know all about everything. Why? Because all the apparently separate objects and things in the universe are completely interrelated and interacting. And it is the same with the two contexts, as I tried to present the other day, the finite and mortal context and the infinite, the eternal and the immortal context. They are completely at one. The infinite and the eternal, by self-constriction, brings into being the finite and temporal. And so that the finite and temporal actually is the embodiment of the infinite and eternal. The separation essentially lies in our own mode of awareness. We are like bats, blind bats. You see, as far as our consciousness is concerned. When one reaches that stage of utter purification and perfection, so that sheer enlightenment at last shines through you, then all that changes. Then you really see for the first time. Now, our task in this world is not to try and change the external world. We can't do it. You see, whatever happens is the result of the natural conditions around us, nature itself, the particular country, its rivers, its mountains, its climate, its mineral resources, its agricultural resources and all that. You can't change that very much. You can change it perhaps a very, very little, you see, by sensible ecological living. Then there is the power of our institutions and our traditions and ways of life and all the technique of our living. Here in this country we have this technique of living. In Timbuktu they'll have another technique, you see, and so on and so on. This exercises a certain influence. And we can change the institutions and this technique of living up to a certain point, but only by degrees. When you get these horrible revolutions which spread destruction far and wide, what is the result? One lot of fools and rascals has been replaced by another lot of fools and rascals. When the young rebel against the old and say, what a mess you've made of the world. All right, the young come into power. And what is the state of the world when they are in power? How far have they succeeded in doing anything right? Or really making things better? They only spread destruction. Because they are perhaps even more full of greed and hate and violence and fear and delusion than we old crocs like me are. You see? It is like that. And there's the extraordinary conceit of the young that, oh no, they know what to do. Look what's happened in Iran just these last 2 or 3 years. It's a tragic situation. Look at the troubles in the Middle East and so forth. Look at the state of the whole world trying to destroy this, that and the other, and they have no power to create and bring into being the truly new, the truly healthy, the truly beautiful, that which truly works for human well-being and fulfillment. They do nothing of the sort. So that the mere changing of institutions won't do it. What is the third factor? The third factor is ourselves, what we are. Because if you look at all our institutions and ways of life and what we have achieved, as we call it, they are the expression of you and me. What you are, what you think, feel, speak and do, and have really understood, and what I think, feel, speak and do. It is we who can change. We can change ourselves. We are the most flexible factor and actually the most powerful factor in bringing about a new world. People sometimes turn around and say, oh, you religious people, you just talk a lot of highfalutin stuff about which you know nothing whatsoever. And in many cases that is true, isn't it? We do just talk a lot of highfalutin stuff. But we don't do anything about changing ourselves, about transforming our mode of awareness of existence, which is the most important thing, transform our whole mood. And that is done by living the good life, the pure life. This is where the sealers definitely come in, you see. And then, when we practice the sealers, we will find that our ability to think out what is the good, what are the principles on which life may be based, that improves. Otherwise, if we try to just think out these things and our psyches are impure where the moral aspect is concerned, we will always think wrongly. Always. I mentioned the other day that even great philosophers, and they were really wonderful philosophers, they produced marvelous philosophy, men like Hegel and Fichte, I'm just giving two examples. They produced wonderful philosophies, and yet they made colossal blunders also. For example, when they said that the ruthless extermination of whatsoever opposes the great ego is necessary. Hitler was a wonderful example of that, and it looks as if the Ayatollah Khomeini and people like him are another example, and perhaps Colonel Gaddafi and others. They are examples in the 1980s of that sort of thing. So all that is not going to do it. It is our changing, our transforming ourselves, our purification that matters. And we can be the forerunners, the harbingers of a new world, which would really entitle us to be considered as true Buddhists, people with true wisdom. The Buddha was the embodiment of wisdom. He was the Lord of compassion and wisdom. We have to become the lords and ladies of compassion and wisdom, and bend all our energies to that task more than to anything else. And that will be the most practical thing we can do in our life. Nothing else will affect the world. Because if we become like that, We become like the sun, and by virtue of what we are, we influence those around us. They won't know how we exercise that influence. It will just happen naturally. And they will undergo transformation too, even in a slight degree. Even if even in a very slight degree, the whole nation experiences that change, the real change in heart and mind and inner consciousness. And therefore, in all the actions that are performed by that nation, then there will be peace and harmony. And life will be made worthwhile living in the true sense. And it is our responsibility to see to these things, understand these things, and carry on. Don't believe a word of what I say. Consider it. Thank you very much indeed. I'm deeply grateful to all of you for your kindness, your endurance, and your attentiveness. And I must thank Mr. and Mrs. Pearson for their very kind service of getting the room ready with all the chairs and so forth. They've done it every day most faithfully. And I must thank Martha also for all that she has done. In the absence of our dear old friend Brett. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.